humidity built the snowman, and sunshine brought him down. It's time for the Saftacast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, editing, or publishing. I'm your host, Scott C. Last episode, 49, was our two-year birthday, and today's episode is our golden anniversary, at least in terms of episode count. It is number 50, with the one and the only Letitia Trent. But let's hold off on talking about that interview just for a second, because I like to start off the program, if you haven't noticed already, or maybe this is your first time, I often like to do this, a little news from the Sundress Academy for the Arts and other things. First and foremost, let's talk about those other things, namely this podcast. I could ask you if you enjoy this program, but your answer will most likely be yes, because I know you do. But if I were to ask you the question, would you like to work on this program? Then your answer might be a little different, but if your answer is indeed yes, well, it just so happens that here at the Saftacast, we are looking for an intern, someone to help us out on the program behind the scenes and possibly in front of the scenes. Visit our own website, saftacast.com. Our menu has a little thing at the top that says internship opportunity. Click on that and you'll get a lot of the details there. But maybe your idea of an internship isn't with the Saftacast, but with Sundress Publications in general. Well, Sundress is looking for interns, editorial assistants, etc., to learn about all the opportunities out there and to pass on those opportunities to someone who might be interested. Visit sundresspublications.com/interns.htm. That address again, sundresspublications.com/interns.htm. Applications are accepted for all positions on a rolling basis, and many of these positions are expected to begin this summer, including the one on the Saftacast. So get those applications in, because we look forward to hearing from you, and we look forward to working with you. Now, on to today's episode, episode 5050, if you want to call it that, with Letitia Trent. It's a great interview, as you would expect on this program, especially from someone who is so kick-ass and someone who is so invested and enjoys horror movies. So it's a good conversation, as we both have a deep affection for cheesy 80s slasher films and much more. But there's a lot more to Letitia than just horror films, as you'll see. One quick note before we get into this, a little program note. We didn't discover this until after the recording, but there was a little problem with the volume level and the recordings when we were doing the mixdown and everything. So just as a heads up, the volume levels may get a little wonky at times. We apologize here at the show. Don't worry. Now, on to today's show. Wait, first, we should probably hear the theme song.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you in the can, sir.
Okay, cool. Yep. Sounds good.
So welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. We've been thinking about you for a while, having you on here. I think we're trying to get every Sundress author on here at some point.
Oh, cool, cool.
But anyway, it is good to have you. Thank you for taking some time out to be here with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'd like to start off the show with the burning question that is on everyone's mind.
Okay.
And the burning question today is, if you could eliminate one of the 12 months, which would you get rid of and why?
Okay, this is hard because, I mean, you could go with August, just because August is always bad. It's just too much summer. But then, like, February is the easy choice. March is also bad. I don't know. This is hard. February, there's no need for it. It's just a waste of calendar space. It's short. You wouldn't even miss it, really.
I mean, some people might get annoyed that Valentine's Day is lost.
Oh, that's right. See, yeah. I didn't even remember that was a holiday. Well, I mean, March could go as well. There's Easter, right? That would probably make some people upset.
Sometimes it happens on March. There's also Lent, too. That's kind of important for many people. August, though, you're right about August. Well, no, that has Labor Day.
Yeah, but for who gets Labor Day off, really?
Ah, good point. Maybe June, then, because June doesn't have any holidays.
That's true, but June, it can be lovely. June isn't sort of the nasty, like, armpit time of the year yet.
Good point as well.
It kind of depends on where you live, though. I mean, sometimes it's always armpit time.
Yeah, welcome to South Florida.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a good choice. I could be down with February.
Yeah. Done.
Done and done. We'll just, next year, we're going to skip January straight into March. Oh, boy. Anyway, how have you been recently?
I've been great. I went to AWP for the first time, which was fun. So that was good.
First time, really?
Yeah, it's kind of surprising. I've avoided it for so many years because just the idea of so many people was overwhelming. And I don't know, I just imagined all those tables full of books and it was very intimidating, but it was just tables full of books and people. Those are, you know, I could do it. I was surprised.
What was your general impression going to it for the first time?
I mean, I didn't do many panels. I didn't go to a lot of the readings. I went to the one I was part of. I decided to take it really slow, so it was really good. I did, you know, I did not push myself to the limit. I thought it was fun. It was like a big, you know, it was like a big reunion full of people I only knew from the internet mostly. So that was very fun for me to meet people for the first time, particularly all the sundress people. That was really, really cool.
Did you have a chance to see Los Angeles at all?
A little bit. I did. And I was actually really impressed. I had this impression of LA that came from, I don't know, various unreliable sources. I just thought that it would be just like rich people holding coffee, but it wasn't. It seemed like a very alive, real city with a very vibrant culture. And I was just very impressed by it. And the weather was great. And I was just like, wow, I could live here, which had never occurred to me before.
Do you think you're going to go next year to Washington?
I just can't. Isn't it in February? That's the month I want to eliminate, right? I think someone told me it's in February next year. And Washington? I don't know. That sounds like torture. I mean, it could be good. It could be good. I have mixed feelings, as everyone does, about AWP, I think, you know, for what it does and what it doesn't do well.
It's like any convention. It has its pros and cons.
Right. It is so nice to see people, though. That's the biggest thing. It's an excuse to go somewhere you haven't been and go see people, which I need to take more excuses to do that.
What's it like, you know, having a writer community where all of your friends are essentially digital and everything, and then to meet all of these people in real life?
I thought it would be weird. I was very intimidated. I had these thoughts like, what if they're really tall and I'm going to be surprised by that? What if people don't like me, or what if I'm disappointing in some way? But people were just like that. It was a very strange feeling of meeting someone for the first time who I've only seen through, you know, selfies or a Facebook picture. And it just, they automatically, those two, the real person and the internet person, kind of joined up in my brain. And it just seemed very natural. It was a very, very interesting and helpful experience for me to not feel so awkward in the future, to know that it would be okay. And it was. It was great.
Is it similar or not to when you read an author's work and you think you get a mental impression of the person and then you meet them in the real world?
You know, I've had that happen, but where I meet them in the real world and I'm very surprised and it seems very incongruent with what I know. That's often been my experience with people I've only read their work. But I feel like kind of Facebook and Live Journal, which is where I met a lot of the people from Sundress, which is old school internet, like when the internet was cozy and your mom wasn't on it, that kind of thing. I just think that there's sort of intimacy in that kind of writing as opposed to one's published writing that made the persona match the person a lot more.
That's true. You know, you can't judge a book by its cover. You can't judge an author by their work sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had some disappointments in that area, but that's okay.
There's a part of me that wants to ask about those disappointments, but we're not going to rank on anyone on the show.
No.
Have you had that experience in your own writing with somebody coming up to you and being like, wow, I did not expect this?
I don't really know that I've ever had the experience of someone who knows my writing and not me, you know? I don't think anyone's read me enough to come up to me and be surprised by who I am as a writer. Yeah, though that would be fun. I'd be curious how I see him on the page versus in real life. I'm just curious about that anyway, because it's something I can't ever know, because I can't really see myself in that way. I'm very curious about that.
You've got to hunt yourself out on like review sites and everything and see this is what they're saying.
Yeah. Oh, I try not to do that, though. It seems anxiety-inducing, and I try to avoid that as much as possible.
Like the actor who says, I don't read the reviews of my work.
Right, yeah. Probably for the same reason, too, because they know they're probably bad. That's probably my perception. If I read it, I will probably be sad, so I just avoid that.
I always wanted to do that. I always wanted to get to the level of where people are writing works about me, like slash fiction, just so I could log on to the forum boards and write the most vile, obscene stories of my own characters. But knowing the internet, the only response would be like, wow, you've captured his style so well.
Oh, that would be so fun. I often wonder if famous writers do this kind of thing, sort of like make up a fake name and go to a forum about themselves and just experiment. So I bet people do. I bet people do.
I wonder if Stephen King does that.
I bet he does. He seems like the type. I was even thinking of him. I thought he probably does that for fun. Though he's very open in his own person, on his own. I'd be really curious if I were Stephen King to read some things.
Yeah, he is very open. Just like he is. Like, not many writers would openly admit, yeah, I was so high on cocaine, I do not remember writing that book.
Yeah, there's a couple, but right? Was it Cujo? What did he say that about? We all could be that productive when we can't even remember. Like, if I could write Cujo stone cold sober, I'd be happy. Like, that would be great. But no, Stephen King's just pumping out books he can't remember.
I don't know how he does it.
I don't either.
Where does he find time to, like, eat?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I don't know. And to do all that cocaine in the 80s. Like, how did you have time for all these drugs and all your writing? And he was making movies. He made Maximum Overdrive around that time.
Yeah.
As well. And you can tell from the preview of that, the trailer, that those were the same times. Have you ever seen the trailer for Maximum Overdrive?
I've seen more of Maximum Overdrive than I want to.
I love that scene where the guy gets nailed in the crotch with a soda can or whatever, and that's always that's my go-to moment. There's a lot more to that movie, but that's just a good bit of a slapstick there. I was happy with that.
Are there other Stephen King films that you find charming, either for really good, they're really good, or they're really bad?
I have such a soft spot for him in all iterations, his books, his movies, even though they're mostly terrible. I mean, Carrie's great. It's a fantastic movie and book. I have some of the bad ones I love, though. I mean, it isn't actually bad. It just suffers from some budgetary issues, I think. But I think actually the childhood parts of it and the performance by Tim Curry is really, really good and scary. And it's one of my first memories of something scary really capturing my imagination. The clown in the sewer grate or whatever it is, the drainage thing. And the we all float down here. I love that whole miniseries, though, even though it's sort of, it's very 80s. I guess it was late 80s, early 90s when that came out. But I love that. And I've seen some bad Stephen King miniseries in my youth. All through the 90s, there seems like there was one every week. There was like the Langoliers and the Tommyknockers and...
Oh,
there were so many.
The Langoliers with Bronson Pinchot.
Yes, in his very subtle performance.
Oh, yes. And the Tommyknockers with Jimmy Smits.
That's right, Jimmy. Oh. That book and movie, it was just so, like, what is going on? What is going on right now? There's green stuff and aliens, and I don't want to give it away, but I really couldn't if I tried. I don't know what was going on there.
I wonder if he was high on cocaine when he wrote that one, too.
I mean, probably. And there's also that movie about the guys going out for a camping trip. And then there's, like, I swear, isn't it, like, butt aliens? Do you know this one?
Oh, yes, I know the one you're talking about. What is it? Dreamcatcher.
Dreamcatcher, right. And the guy has, like, an internal voice that's different than his regular... Oh, yeah, that one... Actually, it was quite charming until the butt aliens.
That's
I'm down with like guys getting together in a cabin, you know. I like that. I'm like, all right, this is a good setup.
I think the only good Stephen King films, honestly, are the ones that have very little to do with horror. Mm.
Like what ones?
Shawshank and Stand By Me.
Mm. Stand By Me is really good. I like Misery.
Good point, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that one has the tension going for it. And the setup is so perfect, it would be hard to... It's just really an interesting, compelling setup. Yeah, those two are good. I love Stand By Me, so good. But that's kind of about the whole... That's really what Stephen King's mostly about, is the horror of childhood, right? Like, childhood is the time when things are frightening and you have no control and you're kind of learning about life and death and the vulnerability of yourself and your parents. And, yeah, I think he's actually really keyed into stuff like that.
What is the real horror? Monsters or puberty?
Definitely puberty, right?
Oh, yeah. I blocked those memories out quick. While we're on it, you were mentioning it's like one of the first times you were ever scared was Tim Curry. You know, what are some of your earliest memories of not only being scared, but embracing that horror?
Yeah, that's a good question. I love horror so much. I feel like it's one of the most sort of psychological genres. It's digging down there in the unconscious in a very direct way. But I was never allowed to watch horror movies when I was a kid. But my mom was really into true crime movies and television. So like America's Most Wanted and anything about murder and like real life stuff she was very into. So I was often scared as a kid, but not from horror films. Just about the sort of likelihood of being kidnapped and murdered, which was a very big thing in the 80s. I don't know if you remember, but like children being kidnapped was like such a theme in the wider culture. And I just have a lot of vivid memories of that fear, like that being something I was always aware of, that like, you know, you could be, there was stranger danger and there were kids on the milk cartons. And but later, I always wanted to watch horror movies. And I remember really distinctly wanting to watch Child's Play. She wouldn't let me. I mean, I actually only watched it like 3 years ago. And I thought, oh, I really could have probably handled this. But the It thing was interesting. When I saw that miniseries, I was, what, 10, 11? And I remember being so scared that I had trouble going to bed, and I was like really shaken by it. Just that little clip of the clown in the sewer or whatever. But I was really scared of it, but I also immediately wanted more of it. And I actually read lots of Stephen King books around that age. I picked them all up and I read them all at probably too young of an age, really. But it was a good formative experience to get that all out and get to. I don't know. There's something that I really needed it somehow. It was helpful. It kind of helped me to sort of process a lot of the fears I had. And then for a while, I didn't watch or read much horror because I thought, oh, I want to be literary. I want to watch something dramatic and quality. And I had this real like sense that horror was of a lesser genre that I think I got culturally somehow. But then I turned around very quickly and realized, no, that's where I need to be. That's what I love.
That passion hasn't gone away then.
No. I think more so. I just go through these periods where all I can do is watch horror movies. I just need it. It's like a good drug. Not like Stephen King cocaine stuff, but like it's helpful some way.
So I'm curious that you watched Child's Play as an adult, you know. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts on it, looking on it as an adult now? You mentioned that it's like, oh, I could have handled this then. What else notes do you have looking at a movie like that as an adult?
Gosh, I think Child's Play is so fun. I love that. As an adult, I've watched all the slasher movies from the 80s that I wasn't allowed to watch. And I just think they're all kind of brilliantly onto something. They all got a lot of criticism, and that was the time when people were criticizing horror films for being misogynistic and violent, needlessly violent. But I don't know. I just feel like they were keyed into some kind of anxiety that is played out through them in a very explicit and visceral way. And I just appreciate them so much. Child's Play is a little bit less, I'm trying to even remember what my thoughts about it were besides this is really fun. That's about all I have for Child's Play. But there's other films that mean a lot more to me that I watched as an adult later.
I was the target age that was terrified by Chucky.
Yeah. I mean, having a doll that comes alive is just, that's a scary thought as a kid, because that really is a thought that crosses your head, right? Like, your sort of ability to judge between what's real and what's not is still a little bit shaky, and so that seems like a possible scenario.
I did love, though, the reboots in the 90s when they did Bride of Chucky and Seed of Chucky.
Right.
Those, I think I saw Bride of Chucky in the theater, and I was like, this is great.
Yeah, I don't know that I've caught up on those, but they always look pretty amazing to me, so I do need to, like, watch all of them. I'm all about these sort of probably bad but really fun, like, franchises in horror. I don't know. I find them – I can consume Friday the 13th movies all day. I don't even care. Like, they're just, there's just something about those franchises with their – they're established characters and beats, and you kind of know what's going to happen. There's something about it that's very appealing to me.
You mentioned a moment ago there are other films, though, that mean more to you as an adult. What ones are you thinking of?
I really love Nightmare on Elm Street. I think that's a really good one. There's just something so beautiful. I think it's poetic. I think it's really a beautiful setup. And I mean, as it went on, Freddy became like a funny kid. He had all these quips and he was always like cracking jokes. But that original one, I think it's something very visceral and beautiful about it. That idea of the dream state and something getting you in your dreams and that manifesting in reality. And I also love this movie. It's not very well known. It's called The Burning. Have you ever heard of this one?
No, I haven't heard of it.
The Burning is great. It's got tons of actors that later became sort of semi-famous, and I can't even remember the names now, but it's a camp slasher, but it's very much lingers on the sort of coming of age piece of camp films, and you kind of get to know these characters, and it has kind of, you know, the good guys and the bad guys, but they're not so it's not so binary as in a lot of slashers when you're set up to sort of hate everybody and so it's okay when they die. This one's a lot more ambiguous, and so there's a lot more meaning when things start to happen. It's a really, I really love that one.
Holy shit, I'm just looking it up now. Jason Alexander's in it?
Yes, that's right.
And Fisher Stevens?
Yeah, it's got quite an interesting cast. I love that one.
Holly Hunter's in it?
It's kind of amazing. And I'd never heard of it until I did my podcast, and one of my fellow people, podcasters, suggested it. And that one is one of my faves.
Mental note, I've got to see this film now.
Yeah.
Because I too share a love of the 80s slasher films.
I think that there was like this sort of easy interpretation of them, like with the whole final girl thing and the idea of, you know, the virgin lives and there's all sorts of problematic aspects to that. And I think there was, I used to know stuff about the theory around this, but I just think that there was sort of an easy narrative about them that got established. And it didn't really get examined more deeply. And there's so many variations on that formula. And also, slasher movies were always so aware of that formula themselves. It's not as though they were just sort of doing it and there was no awareness of it. Or very early on, slasher movies themselves played on and sort of made fun of those templates. So, yeah, I think they're a lot smarter than people give them credit for.
And then you get what I think is one of the best horror films of the last 10, 15 years, which is The Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah, that one is really good. Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot. Even in the 80s, one that I think of that did that, is it Slumber Party Massacre? Which one is that? Is it Slumber Party? I can't remember. There was a lot of massacres in the 80s in the movie titles. I think it was Slumber Party Massacre. Written by like a sort of semi-famous feminist playwright or writer. I think also directed by a woman. It had a killer who carries this enormous drill, which is so clearly a sort of phallic symbol. He's always like draping this enormous drill in front of his crotch area, and it's just like so obvious, the sort of metaphor, but it's such like a brilliant take on all that. That one's a really good one too.
Yeah, I think another one you're talking about.
I mean, it's just kind of funny. It's very aware of the sort of, you know, the knife, the sort of that instrument that stands, according to certain theory, stands in for other things. And yeah, anyway, I dig those movies a lot.
Are there horror films that still scare you?
That still scare me. Let me think about that. That's a good question. I mean, I think ones that are sort of about interpersonal violence and loss are kind of scary to me. And I'm thinking more actually about the book than the movie, but I think about The Shining. I love the movie, but I love the book more because it's kind of about a family that did have... So in The Shining, the movie, like clearly from the beginning, Jack Nicholson is not sane. Like there's no sort of loss of sanity. He just sort of starts out like, oh, this guy's not right. But in the book, there's a lot more of a gradual, and the idea that of sort of this nuclear family doesn't really work. It breaks down. There's sort of this violence inherent in it. There's this sense that the people that are supposed to care for you are going to hurt you. Those kind of films that play with those tropes are still pretty scary to me. Something like Carrie is also kind of scary to me, to keep up with Stephen King. I don't know why. The sense of like what being rejected and isolated and what that can do to a person and make them do in response. I think those kind of films are pretty scary.
But it's not necessarily monsters or...
I don't think so. I mean, monsters, I love monsters. I love vampires. I have to get into zombies. I mean, you know what? Some of the Romero movies are actually terrifying. It's not really the zombie part, though. It's sort of the, gosh, I don't know. It's more the human response, which I think is the typical way zombie movies really go. Zombies are more like the device through which we get the humans fucking things up really badly.
That fatalistic trope that Romero puts, we're all doomed. There's nothing we can do ultimately.
Yeah, and we'll, you know, and we'll kill each other before anything else can kill us. That kind of thing. There's that one where, the second one, was it Dawn? The one where they're all in a mall?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that one's great. It has some obvious moments like, okay, consumerism, I get it. Because all the zombies are coming back to the mall because that's where someone says a line like, this is where they wanted to be when they were alive. So they're all sort of zombie walking back to the mall, which is also a very 80s image. I don't know if anyone goes to the mall anymore. But that one ends in a sort of depressing place. I mean, they go away in the helicopter, I think, but there's kind of no, I'm spoiling this movie, I guess. But there's still no sense that anything's going to go well. Any kind of like civilization you build up against in order to protect yourself is ultimately going to fail, seems to be the message there, which is kind of scary for me. I would like it not to fail.
Whole different vibe than Chopping Mall.
I haven't seen that one.
Real quick, the plot is that, okay, a security force made of robots is implanted into a shopping mall to be automated security, and they become evil.
That always happens, right?
Yeah.
People should know that any sort of robot protection is going to go bad.
RoboCop, Terminator, yeah, pretty much everything. Yeah, Short Circuit.
Don't do it. Short Circuit, even. Did that go bad, though? I remember crying at Short Circuit because of the oil leak part where he's, like, bleeding.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I remember about Short Circuit. I saw that when I was a little kid. I was very sad.
But the other robots turned evil, though, and they tried to kill him.
Did they? Oh, okay, yeah. That would explain what was happening. I get it.
I've known far too much of this stuff. Do you ever feel like that? Like, you are too nerdy for your own good?
Yeah, that's a pretty common feeling. I'm nerdy about something that makes people uncomfortable though, which is even worse. Like being nerdy about horror movies makes people sort of look at you a little askance, like, I wonder what's wrong there. I think there's just something about liking horror. I'm in a psychology program, and so at some point someone asked a question like, what if one of my clients is like really into horror movies? Is that a concern? And I thought, oh, you know, even people who are studying this think that that's a big problem. Yeah, people are so weird. But I don't trust people who can't at least try something frightening. I just feel like there's a little something about that that means you're not... My sort of bias is that if you're not willing to engage in something scary and look at it, then I get a little bit worried about you and your ability to handle the real horrors of life, you know?
Is that why you enjoy horror films so much, is that it's a way to kind of counter the real horror of life?
I think that maybe. I think it provides me with a safe, you know, 90-minute visceral experience of horror, and it's contained, and at the end I'm okay, even if the people in the movie aren't. And it's like, I don't know, it almost feels like practice. Like, okay, I can have like this elevated heart rate, I can be afraid, and I can come out of it and I'm okay. It just feels sort of therapeutic to me.
I find joy in just looking at it and going, wow, this is crap filmmaking. This is beautiful crap. And you're making tons of money off of what was a $15,000 production.
But I mean, being able to look at something difficult is kind of a good skill, I think, too, you know, even beyond the like little catharsis or, wow, this movie's bad, but so fun. I don't know, but so many horror movies don't actually relate to things I'm really scared of. That too could actually be why they don't bother me so much. I mean, I'm not really scared of monsters, but, you know, but they interest me.
Yeah, the real monsters are out there, but
right.
They're not zombies carrying machetes.
Right, which wouldn't be, I mean, would that be scary, though? I mean, could the zombie use it?
Maybe. Yeah. In your opinion, what makes a bad movie? Like, bad. Not bad, so bad it's enjoyable, but just...
I think if nobody's having fun, it's probably bad. You know, there's bad movies where people are committing to terrible lines. There's some sort of vision there, some sense of we're having fun, even if it's, you know, not quite working. But if everyone's just sort of going through the motions, that's probably when it's bad. Or when there's like a serious to it, like it's too serious. The sense of like, we're making this thing, it's important, and it's just really not. I think that can hurt a movie.
I would almost go the opposite. I think that's what makes it, when they're sincere, like they have no cognition, this is a bad movie.
Well, that's like the having fun and we have some sort of vision. Like, yeah, what I mean is like self-importance to me is a little different than sincerity. I do enjoy sincerity. I agree with you. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe, yeah, this is a hard thing to pin down, actually. This is a good question. I'll have to think about it. Because I actually have done I've thought about this a lot. Like, what makes a good bad movie versus a bad movie? But, yeah, I want to write an essay about it or something.
There are some movies they're so bad I can't sit through. And I've tried. It's bad.
Like what?
I'm trying to think some of the worst I've ever... there are two films that have made me physically nauseous, though, just with how bad they are. One was The Flintstones, the John Goodman...
I think I remember that from when I was younger. Oh my gosh.
And the other was Alien vs. Predator Requiem.
Requiem. Oh my gosh. Which one was that? Who was in that?
Nobody worth knowing.
Okay.
It was the sequel to the reboot crossover.
Oh, wow.
Movie bad. Movie go away.
But what made that bad? Like, do you have a sense of like what made that bad?
I don't remember, except walking to the bathroom going, I think I'm going to be ill with just the pain from this. But I know that the dialogue was bad. The CG was not used right.
Mm.
And the plot was just it made no sense to me anymore.
Mm.
Far too oft. And I'm okay. Just by themselves, they're ridiculous premises. But at least have some enjoyment of the source material?
Huh. Maybe it's like, sometimes I feel like movies try to be too complicated, whereas those movies were very simple in some ways. Like, there wasn't an attempt to, like, make some complex plot, you know, in the original Alien or Predator. There wasn't a lot, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'd have to see, I want to see that really bad movie, though, now. I haven't kept up with any of these Predator movies.
The last one was okay. You know, good premise, okay. You know, interesting way of doing it. I'm okay with it. It wasn't great. It wasn't a masterpiece, but all right. This will kill 90 minutes. It's cool. Anyway, if you don't mind, let me backtrack for a little bit here. What about true crime? Has that stuck with you as well? Or is it just the horror movies?
I love true crime. I have a more complicated feelings about because it's like, true crime is a little more, it's a genre that's aimed at women specifically, which is an interesting thing to realize. And the way true crime is framed is often really like troubling because it usually looks for like, well, what are some real news stories that have some really like sympathetic victims, which usually tends to be like white middle-class people who are killed by somebody who you're able to sort of label as a bad person. And it kind of like, I don't know, it's an odd, I am still fascinated by it, but it's a genre that has a lot of issues. And there's a whole channel of it that I used to be a bit obsessed with. It's called Investigation Discovery Channel. And it's full of just terrible reenactment type shows with like titles like Swamp Murders. And there's this whole show devoted to Amish people who've murdered each other. A whole show devoted to twins who are evil. I think it's called Evil Twins. It's just it's sort of a more exploitive in a icky way. But I still am really attracted to it. I don't, and that one I think I feel like I need to think about more why I like it. Because it's not really fun. It's often a big bummer to watch true crime. But I've always been attracted to, like, things that I later regret that I've looked at sometimes. Like, yeah, true crime is one of those things where I have a little bit of a, like, hold yourself back from that a little bit. Because I just don't know what to feel about it. Because it's real things that have happened to real people. Which one doesn't want to use as their form of entertainment. But I think that one's more like just my anxiety. It's this sort of, like, anxiety relief to see something awful happening and then the show's over. I think it's kind of like the horror movie function, but a little more like reality based. It's a very strange thing to think about. Like, why do we want to see true crime? Why do we want to see horrible things that have happened to people sort of dramatized? It's very, I just think about that urge sometimes. What is that?
Why are we obsessed with serial killers?
Yes. And that's the one that I feel the most sort of questioning it, because I have that interest. I find it very interesting. There's sort of a psychological aspect. I think it's just because it's, how could that happen? How could that be? And there's a fear around that. When real violence is much more commonly, you know, interpersonal with people you know, that's a rare sort of thing to happen, but it does dominate our public consciousness a lot.
Does it perhaps come out of the wonderment of, how could a person's mind be wired this way?
I think so, right? It must be.
I would think the majority of the audience would be able to say to themselves, I could never see myself doing that.
Yeah, I would hope so, right? I doubt real serial killers watch true crime. They probably don't need whatever true crime does for the rest of us.
They don't need lessons, you know.
No.
I'm pretty capable of doing this on my own.
They don't Google how to be a serial killer.
Well, I do not want to type that in my browser history.
No, I mean, I'm sure there's more than you would need to know about that. The internet. Oh.
No one is completely singular when it comes to genres and such. What are some of the other genres and shows and culture that you really jive on when you need a break from the maniac zombie killer?
I mean, I like things that are sort of dreamy and sort of hyper-feminine things. Like, I always think of The Virgin Suicides as my, like, that's like a movie that is all of the things in my head put together. It's, like, very gauzy and pretty and also has something gruesome happening and has a really lovely soundtrack. And I don't know, I'm attracted to sort of, I don't know, as someone said, this feminine gothic, like stuff that's very sort of feminized but also a little bit creepy. So films that fit into that genre are my favorite, I think.
Huh. I have not heard that term, the feminine gothic. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm trying to, like, Virgin Suicides is a great example of that. I think a movie like The Dreamers might be a good example of that. I thought of Only Lovers Left Alive. Though that's vampires. I don't know. Maybe I am pretty singular.
You can't fight what you like.
You really can't, right? Isn't that interesting? Like your interests almost seem hardwired. It's like, I couldn't not like the things I like. And that's a big question for me. Where do your interests come from? They're just sort of bloom in your brain.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated. Like, where can I trace this back to in my childhood or teen years or whenever?
You know what? I bet Catholicism is what made all my stuff happen, even the sort of gothic feminine thing. I bet that imagery is very sort of dark and beautiful, and you have big churches and stained glass windows, and Mary is this sort of flowing, beautiful creature, and all this sort of, like, churches filled with, like, Jesus with blood dripping off of him. I just feel like the sort of Baroque nature of that symbolism is kind of always appealed to me, and maybe you shape that a lot.
It's definitely a trope in all of horror. And why do they always read the texts in Latin?
I don't know. You mean like in Catholicism or horror?
No, in horror film. Well, I understand in Catholicism, but I was discussing with somebody recently, my wife, about this, is that in every horror film, every old book is always written in ancient Latin, it seems like.
Right. That's right. Yeah, I don't know why. I guess it just seems so fancy. We figure, oof, must be real. Something must happen with this book if it's in ancient Latin.
Or some made-up, you know, or they'll be like, well, it's ancient Sumerian.
That's right. That's another one.
Yeah, you never hear of, like, this is written in Punjabi. This is written in French. That means it's always an ancient dead language. This is written in Southeastern American English. This word y'all. Interesting. Now, I find it fascinating where our passions come from. What is our engagement level with that passion? For example, as a horror fan, do you go to conventions? Do you seek out, do you seek out memorabilia?
I don't go to conventions. I never have. I would love to, though, because I do have this lifelong dream to meet Lance Henriksen, who is one of my favorite, like, 80s B-movies. Do you know Lance Henriksen?
Yep, from Bishop in Aliens, and then he was on Millennium.
Yes, and I loved Millennium so much. But he's been in, like, if you go to his IMDb page, it's ridiculous. He's in a movie, like, every week still. But, yeah, so I have this dream of meeting him because I've always had this weird crush on him. And but I've never gone to a convention, and I don't do memorabilia. I'm not a person who, like, keeps track of things very well, so I don't keep stuff. Yeah, I'm just purely, like, a viewer. I'm not really, like, a fan in a lot of ways. Like, I don't keep up with things. I mean, I'm a Lance Henriksen fan, but that's about the extent of my fandom. Yeah, I don't. But I really wish I want to start engaging in the horror world. I just don't know how. It's always felt like a sort of male world to me. If you go to, like, websites and look at conventions and look at, like, entertainment related to horror, like most horror movie podcasts or horror magazines, it just seems like it's guys, a lot of guys. And that's always sort of made me hesitate. Like, do I belong in this world? Am I supposed to be participating in it? So that's always been a bit of a trouble for me.
You mentioned a moment ago, how do you get into this? Well, let's turn our attention for a moment to one of your projects in the past. You mentioned podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from, doing my little background research before the program, that you did run a horror podcast for a while.
It was called The Brood, and we're coming back, actually, which I'm so excited about. But yeah, I did. And the part of the reason why I did was because I was just thinking, like, I don't see any female voices, and I love podcasts. I've listened to them, and I had listened to a lot of horror film, and it was a lot of guys talking. And I just felt like their sensibilities didn't always match with mine. They would sort of pan movies that I loved, and I wondered, is that kind of a gender thing coming in? And I also like a critical horror podcast where you talk about sort of what's going on underneath the, like, whoa, that was a rad kill type conversation, which is a great conversation. But, like, what other kinds of conversations can we have? So I started that podcast with Josh Hansen and Chris Shields, who actually makes horror films, I believe, and acts in them. So it was great. And we're going to start again. So I'm very excited about that.
What are you getting for October, I'm guessing, with Halloween?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and we're currently thinking about what our theme is going to be. We do a theme, and we kind of pick three movies, and it's a fun.
Oh, it sounds great. I love critically discussing it rather than, you're right. On one level, it is great to just go, oh, that was a fun movie, or whoa, that was kind of creepy. But one I come back to in my head is Alice Johnson in Nightmare 4 and 5, and how she is portrayed as a woman, but also becomes Freddy's equal, and then the fifth movie just shits all over that completely.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I feel like horror is a place where these gender things happen very explicitly and in a really interesting way. And horror both kind of like pushes a lot of the cultural norms, but also can undercut them in really interesting ways, in the ways that women can have power in a horror film. I don't know. I just feel like there's something very powerful about what horror can do with gender. And a lot of horror is about gender, in my opinion. Yeah, I don't know if I have a whole lot more to say about that. I probably should have thought that comment through, but I do think it's true.
I think you're totally in the right on it. I, for one, will be listening then, when it comes back.
We did a whole bunch about, I think we did a slasher one, which I think we talked about that a lot, and that's one of my favorite ones because we were all really engaged with it, and we all watched so many slashers. It was amazing, and I just got to sort of love them. I could just consume them all day. But that gender part just kept sticking out, the ways that it could change and flow and switch and surprise you, and yeah, they're very interesting.
So what made you, that was the inspiration for getting the podcast going. Why didn't it stay going?
I had a hiatus. I got pregnant and then had a baby. And it made my podcasting, it made that not really possible. I just did not have it in me to like stay up. And I just couldn't watch very many movies anymore. I didn't have any time and I couldn't figure out a time that I wasn't exhausted. So like, yeah, having a small child kind of like takes away your extracurricular activities for a while, but time is coming back again. So I really wanted to catch it again and not just let that fade away, because that's happened to me before. I start things and they fade away. And I wanted to keep this going because I feel like we had a lot more to say.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of room for it, especially with what you're talking about. So glad to see then that it's coming back and that it just was a temporary hiatus.
Yeah.
Well, I want to return to it. You know, I'm looking at the clock. I'm like, wow, we've spent the majority of this talking just about horror movies, which no problem there. But I want to back up. Earlier you said you're in psychology.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get involved in the psychology program?
I've always been interested in psychology. I don't know where that came from either, really. But for some reason, right after my MFA, I had the thought, okay, I'm going to go into a counseling program. And eventually I did. It took several years. So now, yeah, I'm doing a clinical counseling psychology program. So I'll be a clinician working with people. And, you know, I think writers have a natural interest in psychology. I think you kind of have to, right? You have to inhabit sometimes other people if you're doing fiction, or a certain voice or consciousness in poetry. Or I think you're always curious about what people think and why they do what they do when you write and when you read, too. That's a huge part of reading and film. Like, all the arts have a super psychological element, I think. So this just feels like an extension to me that helps me also feel like I'm being useful in the world if I use that as a job. So it just made sense to me.
What are some of the more fascinating things you've discovered in psychology?
I'm really interested in trauma, which also goes back to the horror part, because like I think a lot of horror and a lot of sort of the gothic tradition is about trauma and sort of working through trauma, whether it be like cultural or individual or gendered or whatever. I mean, ghost stories are about trauma, right? That's what the ghost usually is. I think trauma is really interesting in working with people who've dealt with trauma. And so that's probably my primary interest. Also, mindfulness and how it relates to trauma is another big one for me.
How does it relate to trauma?
As a way to sort of heal trauma, as a way to kind of reorganize yourself, because trauma can really disorganize your experience. And mindfulness has just been, there's been a lot of research lately about the ways that it kind of can help you to be able to self-soothe and to regain a lot of that feeling of being disorganized and scattered that trauma gives you.
I hate to sound like a layman here, but because I've heard the term used a lot, especially in the last couple of years. Can you define what mindfulness is?
It just means like attention, a sort of non-judgmental attention to what's happening in the moment, which sounds super simple.
Like detachment?
No, it's the opposite of detachment, because you're actually really like, you're like with what's happening. You're not kind of looking at it from a distance. There is a certain amount of like you're paying attention to it and you're not caught up in it, but you're also really aware of it. It's about having an awareness of what's happening moment to moment. And not being detached, not daydreaming, not trying to get away from the experience, but trying to sort of be with it in a really intentional way. So like, for example, mindfulness around pain management. There's ways that pain management through mindfulness is about actually attention to the pain instead of avoidance of the pain. So like being able to sort of feel what's happening and really intentionally feeling instead of looking for ways to not feel. And so mindfulness kind of switches on its head the ways we often deal with stuff. And I found it really useful.
Awareness. It feels very Zen-like, very Buddhist-like, the awareness of the now, the ever now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the biggest tradition that has influenced. There is actually a big Buddhist psychology focus, and mindfulness has come from that, I think. And my school is actually affiliated with a particular Buddhist tradition. So that definitely is a big flavor there. But it's also sort of secular in that you don't need to be a Buddhist. You don't need to believe anything about Buddhism.
How does one practice it? Is it sort of like meditation?
You can do meditation. There's different ways of, there's different, all sorts of different methods. Like, for example, I like with my clients to do mindfulness around emotion. And so when, like, someone's feeling an extreme emotion, like, let's say they're upset or they're angry, and I can sort of see that, or they're communicating it, I say, let's pause and let's really feel what's happening. So tell me, let's not talk and just sort of feel in your body, like, where do you feel when you're angry? Do you feel it in your head? Is it like a pain in your forehead? Is it not in your stomach? Well, let's go to that. Like, what does it feel like? What's the actual physical feeling? And so I have them sort of stay with that, the physical feeling of the emotion. And then we stay with it for as long as it's tolerable. And then we can kind of let go a little bit and just say, well, what was that like? Tell me what was happening as you were staying. So that's like one of the specific ways that you can use mindfulness.
I might try that next time I feel a strong emotion, be like, okay, where do I feel this?
It's kind of amazing. The first time I tried this, I thought this just sounds sort of goofy, but I mean, it's so physical to have an emotion, and we so often don't even know where emotion's happening. And it also helps you to really clarify what the emotion is, because often I think I'm having a certain emotion, and then actually it's something else the more I investigate it.
It's absolutely fascinating. It sounds to me a little bit like every time I find when I'm angry at something, I now pause and ask myself, wait, what am I really angry about?
Yeah.
Because most of the time, it's not the thing I'm, say, yelling at.
Yeah.
There's an underlying thing I'm angry about, and I'm deflecting to this thing, rather.
Yeah, I think that's a real big piece of it. And ideally, that's kind of what you might unpeel if you sit for long enough in something uncomfortable. That's the idea.
Absolutely fascinating. So mindfulness, it sounds like a good board game. It's really easy to learn, hard to master.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. Simple but tough. Yeah, I think someone said that. It's really simple but really hard.
I can't believe the hour has flown by.
Yeah, this has been fun.
I'm like, where does it go? And I feel like we've only just begun to even discuss some of the things. Feel free to come back anytime you want to discuss a new horror film. We'll discuss it. Before we let you go, Letitia, what's coming up for you writing-wise? What projects are you working on? What's coming out, etc.?
Well, I have a novel that just came out called Almost Dark. It categorizes as horror, but it's kind of more like a sort of gothic. Yeah, it's more dark fiction, I'd say, than horror. But it's pretty cool. You know, if you like atmospheric, spooky stuff with ghosts that may or may not be really ghosts. Maybe that's a spoiler alert. I don't know. But still, if that's interesting, someone can check that out. I had recently had a chapbook out with Dancing Girl Press called Women in Charge, which is actually about crime and women. So that kind of relates to what we've been talking about. Yeah, and I'm kind of just trying to work on a new novel right now. It's kind of hard to find time with this whole degree ending and little kid, but I'm working on it. I hope I'll be able to finish it out within the next year.
Awesome. We'll have to keep our eyes open on that. And before we let you go, where can the folks find you online? They want to check out your stuff, get to know you a little bit more beyond just talking about horror movies?
Yeah, I have Facebook. Just Trent is the Facebook page. Pretty easy to find. I have Twitter, Letrent. That's my Twitter handle. I also have a tiny letter account. I think it's called Tell Me Something Good, but you should be able to find the link to that on my Facebook or my Twitter page.
I've never heard of Tiny Letter.
Oh, it's so cool. It's like little individual like newsletters. It's just like a newsletter thing, but it's kind of easy to use. And the idea is it's a little bit more like an intimate blogging to the people who subscribe versus a blog to everyone.
Or a Twitter feed that's public or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's just kind of like people who want to know more. You can send them little missives about yourself.
Oh, might have to check that out for the show. Who knows?
Yeah.
Well, Letitia, it has been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, thank you. This has been really fun.
We will definitely keep our eyes and ears, well, our ears at least, open for the return of The Brood this fall. Check out, you know, it's out there, I'm sure, some of the back episodes for people if they want to check it out.
Yep, awesome. It is on YouTube. I think we uploaded them all to YouTube, so they're available. So The Brood Podcast is what you can search there. And also we have a Facebook page.
Cool. Well, we'll have to throw a link up to that and everything, and we'll look forward in anticipation for its return during the witching season.
Yay!
Indeed. Well, Letitia, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
No. And we'll talk to you soon. Feel free to come back anytime.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.